Now I want to introduce Joe Barr, my co-chair, and he'll introduce the panel.
Well, good morning to everybody here. It's a full house. This is exciting to have so many people to be a part of this conversation because we have an A-list panel and a B-list moderator. But we're going to be talking about California and its role as a bellwether state, but also questioning that role because we have an interesting dynamic here with our panel with people from inside California and outside California in different perspectives, and we're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about where California is leading and where it's lagging and who's benefiting from environmental policies, initiatives, and market-based solutions that are out there. So it's going to be a full discussion. I want to introduce the panel now, and starting down on the end is John Laird, and he's Secretary of the California Natural Resources Agency. And then we also have Bob Parasepi, who is the... I practiced it and I screwed it up. I apologize. Bob Parasepi, who's president of the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions and a former deputy administrator for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And then next to him is Jim Connaughton. He's president and CEO of Nautilus Data Technologies, and he's former chairman of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. And sitting next to me on my right, Mary Nichols, who's chair of the California Air Resources Board. And Kevin DeLeon, Senate President Pro Tem, is running a little bit behind, and he's going to join us in progress. So we're going to have a conversation until about 10 o'clock here on the stage. And then at that point, we're going to open it up to all of you, take questions from the audience, and go till about 10:30. We'll have one final question that I want to ask the panel before we adjourn around 10:30. So that's the agenda for the morning. So I want to start out with a question for all of you. And we can't ignore the fact that we're in a presidential election year, and we're about to elect a new president. Looking back to 2008, the last time there was an open contest for the White House, the Energy Department said that the new president would face domestic oil production at historic lows, electricity demand that would lead to increased use of coal, slow adoption of renewable power, and a deceleration of the natural gas boom. So, fast forwarding to today, what advice would you give to the next president on how to balance climate change and energy production, and what do you think of the fact that that prediction in 2008 was a little bit off? We start with Secretary Laird on the end.
Well, it just tells you there's no merit in making predictions. And I think, of course, the tough thing is what we do with it, and I happen to have the misfortune of having in my purview the regulation of oil and gas in California. And you, the introductions were brief, but Mary Nichols is also a former resources secretary and so has had the same assignment. I think the real thing is that what the 2008 prediction shows is that the real prediction should have been about what the goals are of whoever gets elected and how they implement them, not necessarily what people might think are trends. And so if you set a goal of more renewables, you set a goal of less emissions, you set a goal of adapting to the climate, you set a goal of diversity in those non-fossil fuels, you can actually meet them. And so that should be the message to whoever's coming in.
Bob Parasepi.
So if you go back around the same time and look at what the Energy Department or the Energy Information Agency was projecting, like in 2005, what would the greenhouse gas emissions of the United States be in 2015, it would be up 12%, 10 to 12%. And what's happened is it's down about that same amount. So they were about 20% off. So again, making predictions is tough. In fact, I think the Yogi Berra and probably many other people before him said, making predictions is hard, especially about the future. So That's a true statement, as it always is, and we're trying now to project out to 2025 for Paris agreements or 2030 for clean power plans. And what we don't know, and I think one of the key triggers that happened in the last 10 years that I just think was not as anticipated to be as big impact as it has been, was the dropping of the costs of directional drilling and hydraulic fracturing and the production of natural gas at a much lower and consistent price. And it's displacing coal at a very quick pace. That was not anticipated.
So what advice, if you could sit down with the next president, what would you say to them about this balance?
Well, I don't disagree that setting some strong policy objectives and being clear about them can help drive things. Looking at what the incentives are in place can help drive things. And, you know, it's often really a good idea to try to swim with the stream. And if the stream is going in a certain direction, if you can make it go faster to meet your objectives, that's usually a more helpful thing than trying to do it a different way.
Jim Conaton, what do you think about that idea of swimming with the stream as advice for the next president?
I add to that, I call it follow the money. The electricity system is going to see a $2 trillion makeover in the next 20 years. The oil and gas system in America is going to see a $2 trillion plus makeover in the next 20 years. So I'm a markets before mandates, and if mandates make the market-based kind of guy, and if we set about to simplify what we are currently facing, and provide just clearer, simpler signals and methodologies for getting there, that's a lot of money to unleash toward the vision of the future that, you know, I think most people share. So I want to go back to EIA. Every year I would get briefed before the publication of that report. EIA is charged by statute to say what is, not really what will be. And EIA is charged by statute not to take into account potential new market changes or potential new policy changes. They're not allowed to. So when you see this great report and all of you report on it every year, the day it's released, the report is wrong. But it's really useful to know how wrong it is every year because it points you, it says to you, and that's why for the new president, read it and read it in detail and say, am I happy with that picture of present reality? And I think no president should be happy ever with the picture of present reality as painted by the Department of Energy in that statutorily mandated report. Which is why California is able to leap ahead and see past some of that, why the federal government in recent times, beginning with Nancy Pelosi and George Bush sharing a stage on the 2007 energy bill, talk about California-federal combination of improbable proportion, we're able to achieve such big things to say, okay, we know it is not satisfactory, let's find common ground on dissatisfaction and take a leap ahead. That's where that kind of information is very useful. So again, as all of you report on it, don't stop at the description of what they're saying.
Mary Nichols, you're at kind of the nexus of business and policy. And I mean, what's your take on this? What's your advice for the next president?
Well, I'm in the regulation business, so I have a different take than some would. But I think that building on what all the other speakers have said in terms of advice, never underestimate what technology can do if given strong goals and a little bit of time to get there, and set your goals based on science and what you think the needs of the environment actually are, and then work towards that end state rather than assuming anything about what can be or what will be absent those possibilities. California actually is a pretty good microcosm of the entire country in the sense that, you know, we have, some would say, wildly ambitious goals for the quality of our environment and for being a global leader on climate change. At the same time, we are an oil and gas producing state. We are third in the country in that regard. We do not ban fracking. We haven't, and under Jerry Brown, despite people demonstrating in front of his personal residence at various points and, you know, yelling at him at Democratic Party conventions, he wasn't ever really seriously interested. We could talk about why, but it's important to realize that part of the reason why we take the position that we can be a good leader for others, a good example for others to follow, is that we actually have balanced those challenges that the country as a whole faces.
So this leads into, yes.
Because two of the things that just came up were the notion of goals, but the notion of markets versus mandates. And since you, most of you aren't familiar with California, let's talk about one case that has been pretty amazing, and that is almost 30 years ago, the legislature adopted a goal that said we would divert 50% from our landfills within 10 years and set up a tipping fee to fund programs that were related to that. At the time, I was a mayor, and I thought, well, that's a great goal. I'm an enviro. I really support that. It probably will never happen. And when I came on that city council in Santa Cruz, they said, we have about 22 years left in our landfill. If you stay here long enough, you will be siting the next landfill and figuring out how to close it out. Well, that same landfill that's now 35 years later has a life of 33 years. It's moved from 22 to 33. And in the state, we divert 60% from landfills over that baseline, and we have a goal of 75%, and it's within reach. And what it did with regard to markets versus mandates is it really created a mandate but worked in concert with the markets. And I was on the waste board for a while, and we were having one place missing in the collecting of plastics and putting them into pellets to recycle. We incented that in the middle, and the market drove it. So without state intervention, there's plastic recycling with different things, and that was true with all the rest. So you can set a goal. It can be in concert with the markets, and it can just change the way we do things.
And we'd like to welcome Senator Kevin DeLeon. Thank you for joining us. And you are here at, you arrived at the perfect time because I have a question for our California panelists, because I want to get into this idea of California being the bellwether state and what that really means. So I'd like to ask, I'll start with you, Mary, and going beyond the rah-rah-rah kind of answer, why is California a bellwether state when it comes to climate change and environmental policy?
You mean being better than everybody else isn't the correct answer? Why is California a bellwether state? I think it's, as I sort of began to allude to in my answer to the previous question, the challenges that we face within one state, admittedly a very large state which is blessed with some abundant resources, but also a state which also faces, some pretty severe social challenges and from time to time severe economic challenges, is that we've learned to manage through those and to maintain that quality of life, quality of the environment is a top priority. That is, we knew long before, I forget who the first candidate was who said that we can have a strong economy and a clean environment at the same time. People are still saying that as though they discovered this fabulous balance that's possible. This has been the rule in California as long as I've been here, which is I moved here in 1970, which is why I am such a passionate Californian, because I am an adopted daughter of California. But the thing is that it wasn't a question. We knew we were going to have a strong economy, and we had to. We also knew that we were attracting people here because of the quality of our environment. I mean, let's face it, most of us who moved here didn't come here for any reason other than the, and in one way or another, that we were drawn by the weather, the climate, the natural resources that are available here, which in turn led to all the proliferation of other advantages that we have. But I'll never forget hearing Jared Diamond, who has been at UCLA for many years and was the author of a couple of famous books about how civilizations collapse because they don't take account of their natural resources, talking about the fact that, you know, he had been about to get on a plane the year before and accept an offer to go back to a very prestigious Eastern university when he and his wife sort of looked at each other and said, are we really going to go back into that weather again? And they said no. Now, that may seem shallow. It may seem trivial in some ways, but I think it actually is important to recognize that people are here because they know they have something beautiful and they want to preserve it, and they have for a long time.
Let's go down to Kevin De Leon. What's your take on California as a bellwether state?
I think that I probably am going to restate what has already been stated, that we are unquestionably the world leader when it comes to climate change and climate change policies. Obviously, through our policies, I mean, the old narrative used to be that if you wanted to grow an economy, you had to burn fossil fuels. And I think largely we are the world's largest GDP because we did burn a tremendous amount of fossil fuels, and we became a superpower as a result. But I think that the innovative thinking of California and the fact that today we are roughly a third less carbon-intensive state, while at the same time we have grown the economy, we have shattered that narrative that we can actually decouple, delink carbon from GDP. And today we're the sixth largest economy on planet Earth. It's because of the policies that we move forward with a sense of intentionality and purpose. I think we're a state that's largely non-dependent on Washington, D.C., or the Eastern Seaboard for any sense of intellectual capital. Because how large we are as a state, because the rich mosaic and the diversity of the state, we are a nation state, although we're a subnational. And it is because of the policies that we have driven here in California that has had an impact on the rest of the nation and the rest of the world. We are who we are today. It hasn't been by luck. It hasn't been by happenstance. We know that, you know, and I'm sure we'll discuss it, but, you know, when we established AB 32 back in 2006, when Senator Fran Pavley, at the time Assemblywoman Fran Pavley, established the tailpipe emissions measure that were now nationalized in 2011 by our President Barack Obama, there's an irony to it, because if you live in a state that perhaps you don't believe in climate change, perhaps there's a debate between evolution and creationism, and if the Earth is still flat, if you drive a Ford F-150 today, a 2015, 2016, you're getting, you know, a third better mileage efficiency because of what California has done with political capital and political leadership. So in many ways, we've been lucky because Mary has said something that was really important, is that we will go through our ups and downs as a state. And I have no doubt in the future we'll go through one of our downs, you know. But we're a resilient state. And as a resilient state, because of the culture in California, we're less dependent, very much so, on Washington, D.C. for political leadership, even if it's a largely Democratic administration with a Democratic-controlled Congress, with the fact we don't have that today. But it's a political culture here in California that really drives the innovation and invites the venture capital that helps accelerate the technologies that help us meet our wildly ambitious targets, which, by the way, we are going to meet those targets. And there's a scientific methodology to what our madness out in California.
And let's go to John Laird. California is a bellwether state. From your perspective, in terms of natural resources, adaptation?
I think we are a bellwether state, but the thing about it is we never quite have the opportunity to think about that because we're up to our neck in whatever it is. And Mary sort of alluded to it, which is that we are so big, whether it's 39 million people or our coastline, including the bays, is 1,100 miles. We have snowpack, we have mountains, we have one of the biggest deserts. We just have it all. And if you couple it with a political view that we're just going to problem solve and we're just going to take every issue on in a way that's relatively fearless, it converts to that. And it's in managing the resources, and we're by statute now and an executive order supposed to do adaptation or resilience in the resources agency. Just one more example, which is we have ocean acidification, which is the one thing that comes from greenhouse gas emissions and the acidifying of the ocean. And if you combined that trend with what happened in El Nino and our oceans heating up by 5 to 6 degrees off of California, we had this catastrophe off of Sonoma and Mendocino last year where just shellfish was dying in place, starved for oxygen. Abalone shells were washing ashore. Clams were just disintegrating in place in the water. And we have to ask, is that a one-time thing due to El Nino, or is that the first of a whole-scale trend? And as the point person on oceans, I really decided we have four different priorities in oceans, and one of them is ocean acidification. And when I looked around and I walked in the door, we weren't doing anything, and nobody was really doing anything. So I convened a panel of scientists to sort of assess what it meant, and I was at the reception last night talking about residual DDT in California, and if where there's residual unbroken down DDT, it was in the mouths of waterways or places where it arrived in the ocean. And the fact that there was other coastal areas that didn't experience meant there was some resiliency for dealing with it. Acidification, there's not that resiliency. It's happening along the whole coast. So by taking the lead on science, it's happening in the Puget Sound. It's a real issue with British Columbia and Oregon, and they joined with us. We did an entire West Coast science study, and it wasn't just a science study on how bad acidification is and what it's doing. It gave us a roadmap for early actions, even things that to a layperson like myself, that you can breed shellfish with stronger shells that respond to it, which never would have occurred to me in any way. We had that major study released in April. We're moving to implement it, and it's us having to just have the courage to respond to what's happening at the time and how it's happening, no matter how big it is, no matter how big the challenge is.
So let's hear from our two guys from outside of California. You're the outside perspective, and maybe you'll knock us off our pedestal a little bit. So Bob and Jim, Bob, let's start with you. I mean, are we really the bellwether state?
Well, I think all states are bellwether states. This is something that Californians need to get in their heads. You know, they are certainly, and all the points that were made by my really, really good friends are absolutely true. I actually played in that game of using California in work I did in Maryland. You know, I was the first chairman of the Northeast Ozone Transport Commission after the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, which you know, many people worked on, and we were able to pass a resolution of all the states in the Northeast to opt in under the new Clean Air Act to the California Clean Car Standards. So clearly, the Northeast is still the other place that has that going on. I could tell you, after we had that meeting, the next meeting, the room was full like this with lobbyists. So, you know, they realized that that was going to do something. But the other thing to remember is go back a little bit further than the 60s. And I teach a class in environment and climate change at George Washington University in Washington. And when I talk about this federalism thing and the progress we've made, I show two city skyline pictures. One is Beijing last year, and the other one was L.A. in the late 1950s. And you can't tell the difference between the two of them, obviously. And we still have ozone issues in L.A., as Mary will attest to, and it's 50 years since that happened. But when the United States passed the Clean Air Act in 1970, the very first one, many of the components of it, but not all, were modeled after some of the work that was going on in the South Coast air region and work that was going on there. But some of the permitting programs and the technology programs were adopted from some other states, And the Clean Water Act that was passed around the same time in 1970 was built on water quality standards programs that were going on in Ohio and North Carolina and many other states. So you need to remember that every other state thinks that they're doing something. And, you know, the old adage of states are the laboratory for the democracy. And that kind of you know, if you're into diplomacy, you know, when you're talking to other states, you have to recognize that they think they're a leader in some aspect of what's going on. And I do remember when I was trying to get the legislation passed in Maryland General Assembly to opt into the California standards, I had to answer the question, you know, and frankly, you know, why the heck does Maryland want to answer to somebody in Sacramento? So, and I tried to, I worked my way through that. I said, there were some nice people in, I think there's some guy, Coquette, I think, that worked used to work for you that was on the phone with me on that. So that's the concept I think you have to remember, that yes, you are, no doubt. I mean, there's examples for the last 50 years where national efforts and now even international efforts are able to build on the success and the political leadership and California. But, you know, your clean car program and your clean diesel program would not be as good as it is if the federal government hadn't enacted standards for gasoline in the rest of the country, because every time they would leave the state, they would get polluted, they would get contaminated with sulfur and other things. So, you know, it has to be a symbiotic relation, is which what our Constitution is built on.
So, let's go to Jim and this idea of are we the bellwether state? And also, I just add to the mix, who can we learn from?
So I now live in California, and I actually came to California to get out of Washington and to practice what I call a little bit of free market environmentalism. So the companies I've been associated with are all about dramatic improvements in energy usage, dramatic improvements in water conservation, dramatic improvements in reducing the footprint without any help from the government. Be it regulatory or supplemental funding. So that's sort of been my philosophy on what you heard. And by the way, there's a lot of that going on in California. So so please don't ignore the churn of the private sector and innovation that occurs unguided by policy, okay? Certainly supported by shared societal objectives, but unguided, undriven by the manipulations or forces of either Washington or Sacramento. Because it's big. And that's why I think I get to say, when I moved to California, it was almost amusing because people said, how do you like living in the Bay Area? And I said, well, yeah, I love it. It's kind of like being in Washington, but without the ties. Because the level of intensity is the same, the level of you know, and I say this affectionately, self-importance is the same. And it's great because California is one is a big country. You know, California and Texas stand out as countries within a country. However, it's a mixed record, right? So California's way ahead on the deployment of renewable power, which is just great, and setting the RPSs. But the California RPS began at the same time as the Texas RPS, okay? So and began under Republican leadership. So there's it's not a partisan issue. It's a shared norms issue. We should all be taking advantage of. California's way ahead on water resource efficiency and conservation, and yet, while it was able to do this heroic thing on simplifying its congressional districting, California can and shouldn't have done the heroic thing on water markets. You know, it's a really intractable, centuries-old set of issues. But if ever there was a state that could or should get to the other side of this and you know, and do it, it's California. And I regard that as a failure because of the energy and intensity of California. Coastal marine resource conservation, hands down, you know, California's way out in front. And I'm a big supporter and booster of that. Greenhouse gases, sure, okay, but I'm about outcomes, not about statements of intention. And greenhouse gases, sure, but a few things. And by the way, if everything was good, Mary wouldn't be here and the others wouldn't be here because you wouldn't need the commissions because California would be a zero-emission state, and it's not. Today, France, with an economy about the same size as California, has zero-emission power without any new technology. That's a combination of nuclear and renewables. So if you're serious about being a zero-emission power generator, I don't need a single new technology to do it. I would have expected California, as a leader in both nuclear energy and as a leader in renewables, would be putting the two together and creating that base load and that fluctuating peak load that would also support the wide-scale introduction of electric vehicles. Okay, so huge opportunity unrealized in California right now. And so that's a place where California could be a better bellwether. And then on the challenging side, California was a leader in setting air quality standards in the nation, but is now one of the biggest laggards. And I as an environmentalist, I don't give anybody a geography exception. So either you want to cut health-based, you know, improve health-based air quality to the standard that's set at the national and federal level, or you don't. And so, and the letter, and that level's health-based. And so, there's a lot of work. And I want to say, Mary, among leaders, is incredible in this space. And it's really hard. But California's not there yet. Okay, you know, I'm from the East. My dad went to the emergency room every month with chronic asthma, triggered by pollutant levels that California now still sustains. We can do a lot better there. There's a lot more work to be done there. So it's a mixed record, but as a bellwether, California creates some of the biggest problems first and solves some of the biggest problems first, then that's good. But the one thing I also want to then end with is you can be overly ambitious, and we can learn from the failures of that, and so some learning from California, and California then adapts and adjusts, which is good, and then that can help us design better federal policies. But on carbon in particular, the thing I am most concerned about, and I know the state is sensitive to it, is carbon leakage. Okay, so you can really do a great job where you are, but the effect could be to cause investment elsewhere. I mean, I prefer clean energy, capital-intensive businesses be setting up in California. And instead, a lot of capital-intensive businesses aren't coming here anymore and setting up in places with much higher carbon profiles. And so we still have to figure out how to balance the aggression of what's going on in California, the aggression of U.S. national policy now, with the fact that some of what we're doing is causing increases in greenhouse gases elsewhere. And we still haven't solved for that yet, and we need to figure out smart ways to do it.
So I want to pick up on something you mentioned, just talking about France as an example. And Mary, this is for you, and Kevin DeLeon, I want to send it over to you as well. But Mary, you actually said some comments a while back, we must virtually eliminate all sources of climate and air pollution in the next 50 years. Do you really think that's possible?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I do. I mean, as others have already said, you know, we've broken the link between the use of carbon fuels and growth in the economy. That's demonstrably happened and is in the process of happening now. Our goals for 2030 are considerably more ambitious. It's to get to 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. We're in the process of developing the plan to do that, but building on policies and trends. I'm not going to say that everything we do is forcing the market, but I perhaps would draw a little more synergistic line between policy and investment than it would seem that my neighbor here to the right would. I think that we will get there, and we'll do it smartly and efficiently and in a way that also takes into account an issue which is not just here in California, but growing in terms of its discussion globally, because we do recognize, even if we're admittedly a little self-centered, that we're dealing with a global issue, and that unless our policies are translatable globally, we're not going to actually make much of a dent in the problem that we're trying to solve, which is global warming. Other countries in the world are looking to us not just because we've got neat technologies and have been able to, you know, solve or mostly solve our air pollution problems that they're now facing, but we're grappling with the issues of how you do it equitably. And Senator De Leon was a leader on this issue a long time before others even really recognized the problem, which is that unless you're generating benefits that reach everybody in your society, not just the people who most obviously can buy the most expensive new cars or, you know, who are already out there investing in the technologies and getting wealthy from it, you're not going to have the political will in a democratic society to sustain some of these decisions, because they will inevitably have an impact, and in some cases they are, you know, they will have an impact that will have a short-term impact on prices of things, you know. And so the strongest argument that I regard our biggest opponents, because they're the ones who have the firmest grip on our current economy, which is the oil and gas industry, whenever they want to campaign against something we're doing, it's always that we're going to raise the price of gasoline and make it impossible for regular people to drive. And so I think the twist that we have begun to put on this, aside from the fact that it turns out that many, many people, including some of our least affluent citizens, are actually big believers in the future of alternative energy and clean energy. The biggest thing that I think we've done that really is unique in California is not just that we have a climate program or that we have a cap and trade program, it's that we're investing a very significant amount of the proceeds in the communities that have the worst economic and environmental problems, and trying to show how doing that can benefit them environmentally.
Well, let's hear from Senator De Leon, and I did want to get into the environmental justice issue, so this gets us into that realm. And of course, the environmental justice movement has become stronger. There was legislation in the last session that addressed some of these issues, taking cap and trade money, investing it in low-income communities. What's the impact of this? Is this the stronger environmental justice movement actually giving people a voice in the process of creating environmental policy?
Let me say a couple things. One, it's clear that we hit an emotional chord with our friends from the Eastern Seaboard in our recent transplant to California. I don't think things happen in the vacuum. I think it is policy that drives market signals. So no matter how much of a venture capitalist you may be out there, and if you want to make money out there in terms of clean technologies, the first venture capitalists at the end of the day are the taxpayers that are driven by the policies that attract and compound the tens of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars that come. So one, policy drives. And a lot of this stuff in California is left-leaning as we may be in California. A lot of what we have accomplished, both statutorily through the legislative process as well through executive decision-making and the regulatory framework, has not been easy by no stretch of the imagination. We have the best research institutions on planet Earth. So I state it for the record. University of California system is the best, bar none, on the Earth. We have some of the best, finest private institutions in the nation here. But that's not enough, because that's just relegated to panels and forums and think tank groups and white papers that can be submitted and discussed, you know, in forums such as this. You need political capital and you need political leadership. And because of the dearth of leadership, irrespective of political party in Washington, D.C., that's why states among themselves have taken it upon themselves to move the policies that help improve the human condition because of the existential threat to humanity as we know it today. And that's why, you know, although the narrative may be that California is self-indulgent or self-centered, it is the policies that we have driven here in California that have had a meaningful impact. Now, California being California, the sixth largest GDP on planet Earth, we do have a problem. There's no question about that. We have a whole variety of problems, as just been articulated by our friend. France, I don't know if France is the best example to use, quite frankly, since they're reducing their portfolio with regards to nuclear. They're well away and lowering their dependency on nuclear right now. So as an emissions-free, I don't know if it's the best example to use. I would just cite that right there. But with regards to what we're doing as innovative, I don't think anyone's doing it in the country. In fact, I don't think anyone's doing it in the world, is that we're taking our cap-and-trade proceeds, no matter how controversial it might be, whether you believe in cap-and-trade in a free market mechanism or a carbon tax. We're taking billions of dollars, and we're investing these dollars in communities that are disproportionately impacted by both CO2 carbon emissions and other criteria pollutants. as well as short-lived climate pollutants, black carbon, methane, and other super pollutants that our children breathe into their lungs every single day that cause asthma and have really negative, positive, negative public health outcomes. But we're doing this with a sense of intentionality, statutorily, that says the most vulnerable communities that are impacted, GHG, carbon, as well as other short-lived climate pollutants and other criteria pollutants, we will invest in those communities, energy efficiency. We will invest in those communities, tree planting for sequestration. We will invest in these communities to break up the asphalt, the cement, and the concrete and build parks and open space and green space. We will put solar panels on low-income housing for distributed generation. We will actually, and as Mary said correctly, in the United States of America, including California, those who have the financial wherewithal have access to the latest and greatest and best technologies. So if you leave it to a free market mechanism, guess what? It only continues to be stratified unless you statutorily say with intentionality, we're going to invest this money in these communities. So therefore, if you have the financial wherewithal to buy the best technology and you can drive a Tesla and you can have your own charging station, well, good for you. But if you live in Chevy Chase or DuPont Circle or Palo Alto or Santa Monica, I'm not quite sure we're going to meet our macro global targets by having the rich and exclusively elite have the best access to technology, energy efficiency, energy storage, a Tesla. We're not meeting our goals.
Let me cut in right there because I want to get a couple other comments here just on that. Aspect.
I'll come back, but I want to finish the point what we're doing right here because what we're going to do is...
We have a couple minutes left, so we'll come back to you, but Secretary Laird, you wanted to add something.
I wanted to play a little off of a couple of Jim's comments and add to Kevin because disadvantaged communities are one of the reason a water credit system hasn't totally been moved in California because if you look at the drought we are in roughly the fifth year of, when you move water around California, you're able to move it through the rivers and streams to get it from somebody that purchased it and from somebody that sells it. And, you know, in 2013, we set this record of consecutive non-rainy days in the middle of the rainy season that were set in 1884, 1924 in Redding and Sacramento. We broke it. Blew past it by 10 or 15 days, and there were people that owned water in different parts of the state, and the system was at such a historic low that they could not get it, even though they were dry. And the first places that went dry were disadvantaged communities. And so a water market or water credit system has to figure out a way that it's not moving from the wealthy to the wealthy and leaving the others out, and that's the problem. The other thing is Jim said there's not a geographic exception. I can't remember the precise phrase. And France does not have the level of seismic activity we have in California. And that is not a self-selection with California. It's just what it is. And when we ask a question about nuclear, when I was in the legislature, Kevin might have been there, we actually passed a seismic testing bill related to nuclear power and discovered in one of our two plants that there were faults right next to it that were not discovered at the time the plant was built or the work was done on it. And so that is a real issue that's geographically different.
So, Bob Perciasepe, we're talking about policy solutions here, but what about market-based solutions to bridge the gap between the haves and the have-nots?
Yeah, well, I think there's a number of key points that you have to take into account overall, but one of them is that the lower-income communities, vulnerable communities, are being disproportionately impacted by climate change now, not sometime in the future. They're already being impacted, and I think, Kevin, you really pointed out some of the work that you're doing in California to try to balance the approach. Second, and I'll align with Jim a little on this, but then with a proviso, and that is that market-based approaches give us the opportunity to reduce the emissions and to do it at a lower cost than other ways. And that lower cost then is less impact on lower-income communities. The third part, and this is the hard part in my view, is that we have to make sure that it doesn't have an inadvertent impact on the other public health more locally public, you know, near field public health pollutants. And here, you obviously you have the baseline of the Clean Air Act and other statutes in California for public health, but you could have a disproportionate distribution of co-benefits. You know, in other words, we expect to get co-benefits in public health by reducing greenhouse gases because other ones come along with it. And some anticipation, including EPA's own analysis on the Clean Power Plan type of thing, is that some of those co-benefits would be substantial public health benefits. But if those are not equally distributed, that's another thing that you need to look at. And I think, obviously, the other social responsibility issues it can be taken into, all of these things can be taken into account in the design of the market approach. But I do want to say, my proviso, Jim, is that I don't think there's enough magic in the market to do all of this. It's going to have some, there's going to have to be some performance standards, and there's going to have to be some utilization of social responsibility components that Kevin was outlining and others built into the system. So it won't be a pure market approach, but the market approaches, and certainly I am a strong proponent of them, with those modifications, which I think we can learn from in California, because you're facing these issues. You had hearings yesterday on these issues.
So I want to get, and before you do that, I just want to mention we're going to take questions from the audience. So start lining up at the microphone. It's right in the middle there. And we'll go to your questions here in just another minute or two.
I want to say something else.
Okay, so we'll go, Jim, first to you, and then Mary, we'll go to you.
Okay.
Again, to remind, markets before mandates, if mandates, market-based, we're 100% in alignment. Even the libertarians will agree that government must set these performance standards when it comes to public health and other social issues. Even even Gary Johnson, you know, will be there on that. But when you decide as society how far, how fast, for the sake of public health or for the sake of the, climate change, it's really good to set the mark, have it be predictable, have it be durable, and then get out of the way. Because the best market-based regulatory programs have been the ones that have had the least level of government intrusion and manipulation.
Lest anybody think that markets magically create themselves and police themselves, I just want to remind all of us that we started our cap-and-trade program as the United States was still in the depths of a historic recession caused by, among other things, but I think many people agree now, a failure on the part of the people who were supposed to be regulating the markets just from the perspective of keeping them honest to do their job. And one of the issues that we faced in launching this, supposedly simple little program to create a market in carbon allowances is we had to do literally a couple of years' worth of work to set up a system to assure that this thing operated in a way that was transparent and clean and not able to be manipulated by people who would otherwise, whenever there's money around, you can be sure that there will be people looking for a way to game the system. And so one of the things I'm proudest of about our cap-and-trade program is the fact that we have never, ever had a problem where we had to abort one of our auctions or go back after any of the people who were investing in our allowances, and have now been able to extend that system, working with Quebec and soon Ontario, into a transnational system where allowances and money are going back and forth, and we can be assured that we're actually getting the carbon reductions that the program was designed to get. But it's not easy.
Well, let's go to your questions, and we have somebody at the microphone there. Tell us your name and what's your question.
Hi. Whoa. Okay. Now we're awake. My name's Antonia Yuhas. I'm a freelance writer and journalist. I specialize in oil. My questions are for Jim. You had mentioned at the beginning we're getting ready for a $2 trillion makeover in oil and gas. Can you say a little bit more about that? Also, Donald Trump surprised a lot of people yesterday, announcing in Pittsburgh that he has an environmental agenda. And as a former head of CEQ in a Republican administration, do you have thoughts about what that might be?
Yeah. So the so on the first question, just by the sheer weight of the system on power and on oil and gas systems, there's a massive amount of capital stock turnover that's going to happen. It's money that will be spent, and so then it's a question of what's it spent toward. We just saw with the boom in natural gas development in America, and with the boom of oil development in America, we're able to make a lot more of the energy here, and we're able to make it a lot cleaner, okay? And carefully regulating to make sure it doesn't create the negative consequences. And there's a lot of work around that too. But that was that alone, just the shift to natural gas and then American-made oil development was something like $1 trillion with a $560 billion addition to national GDP. So that's a winning combination. Combination of markets, innovation, and strong environmental protection policies. You need all three, so I agree with that. And it's about to happen again. And so the sooner we can learn what's working well in California, learn what we might not want to replicate from California, and translate that into a national policy, a new national policy, the better off we all are, because if we can provide predictable long-term signal, it's amazing, it's well-regulated, it's amazing how quickly the market will adjust to that. In fact, we know from history, Mary was a leader on the implementation of the acid rain trading program. And it did things nobody imagined it could do, because it kind of left the technologists alone to figure out how to comply, and the cop was on the beat making sure they complied. And so it was really effective. We've done that with fisheries. So as I look at this capital spend that's coming, I don't need big stimulus subsidies for that. You do need some government work for this valley of death thing you keep hearing about. That's still a challenge. I'm going through it myself right now. Just that transition from old technology to new technology, especially if it's capital intensive, that's an interesting place for government to really focus in on. But when it comes to oil and gas even, I'm kind of agnostic. I'm about emission reduction. And if it all comes from solar, or it all comes from nuclear, or it all comes from natural gas with appropriate controls, I kind of don't care. So I just want the signal, the compliance regime, and let the technologists and the investors figure out the cheapest, fastest ways to get there. And I'm happy with whatever it is. There's still a little too much picking your favorite today. Wind was king, and now solar's king. But gas was king. Nuclear was king before coal became king. And so we do a little too much of that on the policy side, and I'm as sensitive to it as anybody else, because I've got my favorite technologies too, but I've come to a point in my life where I don't care. Let's have a solid system of emission reduction, try to manipulate things as little as possible, and let the technologists get us there, because America's great at that. California's great at that.
Next question.
Oh, Trump.
Yes. What's your name and where are you from?
Hi, I'm Sarah Terry Cobo. I'm with the Journal Record. We're a business newspaper based in Oklahoma City. I cover energy, which in Oklahoma is mostly oil and gas. I wanted to follow up on something you mentioned, Chairman Nichols, that you said that unless your policies are translatable globally, then we won't make much of a dent in greenhouse gas emissions. So help us out on that. I mean, how do you translate your policies, your very aggressive policies, to oil and gas-dependent states like Oklahoma, Texas, and around the world to oil-dependent countries like Nigeria, Ecuador, Venezuela, China?
As we've indicated here before, it takes a bunch of different things. You can't assume that there's one magic bullet. Pricing carbon is something that we felt like we needed to do, and I think it's important to do. But you cannot ask people to accept the idea that there just should be higher prices if you don't have other policies in place that give them alternatives. So, economists are very fond of assuming that the market will just fix problems and that if something is too expensive, people will use less of it and all will be good. Well, you just cannot go in and say that to people who have to get to work every day and the only vehicle they have is an old pickup truck, just to cite one example. So there is a need to put other policies in place to deal with those things. I think what we've found is that a mix of measures, which have included all of them, have some market element in them. But if you look at how we have achieved the reductions in CO2 that we've achieved, the number one policy success has been the vehicle emission standards, the greenhouse gas emission standards, which were adopted by the Obama administration, and they were adopted both for greenhouse gases and as a CAFE standard. We can talk about whether the CAFE approach is the best way to do it, but the bottom line is, as somebody said, you can't buy a car or truck today that uses as much fuel as it did for that same model, you know, 5 years ago. So that's one very important thing. And reducing the carbon intensity of the fuels, using also a market-based approach to require the fuel suppliers to come up with ways through blends, through investments in biofuels, through alternatives to push the system to be cleaner in that respect. I mean, those policies have to work together. And recognizing, again, that people want to raise their standard of living, and especially people who are just now coming to the point where they are going to be able to afford personal transportation. How do we blend that together with, you know, a functioning transit system, which is, by the way, one of the areas where I will freely admit we are behind other parts of the world in terms of our use of and of transit. So there is no one single magic bullet, and it will differ, I think, from place to place. But I would argue that our willingness to use a diversity of different measures to target these different sources is an important element of what we can show other people, and particularly on the co-benefits, as Bob Perciasepe said, that this is not, you're not just doing this because you want to make the planet better, although we do. It's also because we want to deal with our own problems.
And Bob, you want to follow up on that?
I just want to add to what Mary's saying, and that I think folks in Oklahoma should be interested in, is that the actions that places like California, you know, other states have taken in a variety of ways. Over 30 states have renewable portfolio standards. So it's not, you know, it's an aggregation of all this effort at the state level that is enables the federal government in international negotiations to talk a little bit about what the United States is able to do and the fact that our greenhouse gases are actually going down. So there's no one thing that's making that happen. And so it enabled the world to come together in Paris and actually come up with a durable agreement that is based on bottoms-up country-level commitments. And so folks in Oklahoma should be, well, the proof will be in the pudding over time, but they should be comforted by the fact that there's now a global commitment to start doing the same kinds of things. It's a lot of work to get that to work, as you might imagine, just as it is to get something to work in the state of California. But the idea that that's different than it was 4 years ago, that global commitment, is an important component.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Jim Bruggers. I'm a reporter with the Courier-Journal in Louisville, Kentucky. So this discussion today, and also for much of an all-day session we had yesterday dealing with clean energy, seems to assume that federal energy policy going forward is going to be similar to what it is today. Yet we do have an election coming up, and I think it would be helpful for us to hear your thoughts on, you know, what can we expect under a Trump or a Clinton presidency when it comes to, you know, federal energy policy and environmental policy.
I'll start with a couple of very quick points, and I think everybody will have a point on this. First of all, I think the price of natural gas is not going to go up under any administration, and it will continue to displace coal generation in the United States. That trend will continue no matter who is president, and that will have a downward pressure on emissions from the power sector. The Congress last year enacted production tax credits and investment tax credits for solar and for wind energy that go another 4 years to 6 years, depending on which one you're looking at and when they started. That's not going to go away unless Congress overturns itself. But those trends are going to continue to stimulate renewable energy, regardless of who the president is. Now, what you build on that, I think, is going to be the issue. But those trends, if a new president does nothing, those trends are going to be out there. And so they're going to either try to push, go with this flow, or they're going to try to slow it down for some policy reason that is yet to be clearly articulated.
Let me add to that. The other thing that won't change The 2007 energy bill, that CAFE program, 87 votes in favor of it. It's going to be reauthorized, but California's gone gangbusters. I mean, it's interesting. Bush wanted the same level of ambition as California. The legislation fell short but provided discretion to go tighter. President Obama brought it to the California level. So, you know, that's a pretty nice combination politically, if you ask me. That's not going away. Okay? And it's now, I would rethink the design of CAFE. I think we could make it even more efficient and effective. That's a good conversation to have, but that's not going away. The renewable fuel standard is in that same piece of legislation. And there's going to be a big battle over how to rethink that, but I think it'll be very hard to make that go away. If anything, I hope it's weighted more toward emissions profile and toward BTU content and toward American content, and that's a basis to keep it, you know, keep the political support for it going. So that won't change. And I would note, combined, that set of policies, the ones Bob described and the one I described, that's $2 trillion of net consumer savings, according to ACEEE. So go look it up. It's 17 billion tons of carbon abatement, okay, that's baked into our system now. Bad word, baked. That's sugared into our system. We enjoy that. And so what's going to happen is it's really going to be about power, and it's really going to be, is there a pathway? What happens to the Clean Power Plan at the margin, and what happens with respect to how we understand technology development advancement as it relates to gas in the power mix and coal in the power mix? There's still a big discussion and debate to be had around that, but the core of where we're heading is strong. It's, by the way, and guess what? It's all market-based policy instruments. That's the other thing. And so there's a lot of there's going to be a lot of energy around doing it right, not around whether to do it, I think.
One thing that never occurred to me when I was launching a public policy career 40 years ago, and somebody who is a Democrat, is that there would be limited times that there'd be a Democratic administration in Sacramento and a Democratic administration in Washington at the same time. Of those 40 years, it's been 12 years, and of those 12 years, six of them have been the last 6 years. And so by aligning our goals, we've come to an agreement to remove four dams in the Klamath Basin. We've done a landscape plan on desert renewables that we're trying to finish before the Obama administration is done. We have aligned on water policy and a whole host of things. They have joined with us in Nevada on Tahoe issues. You just look across the range of the challenges California takes, and I'm just not re-saying all the things in emissions and that are there. The election will really determine whether some of those initiatives all across California will still be in concert with the federal government, or whether we'll be going them alone with our own resources and only taking them as far as we can take them. And so it is really a clear choice on that. And admittedly now, there's just rumors, and you can't base it, but the floated name two or three days ago, who might be a Trump choice for the Secretary of Interior, would march in completely the opposite direction on bunches of the issues that I just mentioned.
Yes.
Let me add something too, and I'm not perhaps as bullish. I'm a lot more bearish with regards to obviously what a Trump administration would be, but you know, the control of the Congress, you know, which has demonstrated so far on issues such as immigration reform and other issues that they're completely happy to cut their nose despite themselves and be concerned about getting anything done. The very fact that the most powerful people in Washington, D.C., in my opinion, is not the Speaker Paul Ryan or McConnell from Kentucky. Those two individuals are not the most powerful people in Washington, D.C. The most powerful people in Washington, D.C. are the very small, tiny, elite group of folks who have veto power over everything, which are the Tea Party activists, which Paul Ryan and McConnell are deathly afraid of. They control the agenda and how things flow one way or the other. So I'm not as bullish. I'm more bearish. I think I would see a much more, I think with a Hillary Clinton administration, you'd see a really a true attempt to engage and reach across the aisle, but it'll get to a certain point when, if it's just obstructionism for obstructionism's sake, or to hold on to legacy industries, that you'll see a lot more executive decision-making happening, just like what we've been seeing with the Obama administration. A lot of litigation. That's why the U.S. Supreme Court appointees will be absolutely critical. And that's why California, understanding the political dynamics in Washington, D.C., has engaged more so with provinces in Canada. I just got back from Mexico a few days ago, where I met with the Secretary of Energy, Pedro Joaquin Caldwell, and the President of Mexico. They know the dynamics very well in Washington, D.C. That's why we're engaging with China and with other nations and other states with MOU agreements, because we're not going to, you know, short of military control, short of conferring legal status and citizenship status, controlling the U.S. military and the Federal, you know, Reserve, you know, we're going to just do what we do in California, irrespective of what happens in Washington, D.C., if it does goes against the interest of the people of California.
So let's see if we can get through. We just have a couple minutes left to get through these next three questions. So what's your name and where are you from, sir?
Good morning. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. Thank you, California, for sharing John Muir, Gaylord Nelson, Aldo Leopold's children with us and us with you. Governors come out here currently for campaign donations. Thank you for sending back those governors with their full wallets. Appreciate that.
Senator Mark Leno, who's my chairman of the Budget Committee, because he is originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay. Thanks for giving
my question is about Paul. Is about Paul Ryan. I mean, have you thought about bringing him out here for like a deer hunt and a meeting some retired Packers? I mean, but more seriously, don't.
I'm in charge of permitting. He's going to have a permit.
I just, my suggestion, my question, why don't you, would you invite power brokers like Ryan and others out here to see what you have? Does that happen?
No, absolutely. I mean, listen, we have really great Californians in Wisconsin right now. The Green Bay quarterback is a Californian, you know. Aaron Rodgers, you know, leading the Packers. Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader from Kern County, one of the largest, you know, county oil producing counties in the nation, is always in my office. He always comes and visits, and he's an awfully affable guy. He's part of the California State Legislature. He was a Republican leader in the California State Assembly. I don't know Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan strikes me as an awfully nice guy. He strikes me as an intelligent individual. But one thing that you realize, intelligence is not enough, and having a good heart is not enough. You have to have the political courage and capital and leadership to move an agenda with intentionality. Short of that, nothing happens. That's just the reality. Things don't happen in the vacuum, because they happen because you had great individuals and great ideas. If you're not willing to burn political capital to move the agenda, it doesn't happen. And I see someone like Paul Ryan just besieged and almost trapped from within his own Republican caucus, and he's paralyzed to do anything for fear of, you know, the footsteps, you know, that are going to come right behind him. And that's what adds to the paralysis in Washington, D.C. Seems like a nice guy, seems like a smart guy, but so what?
And if he comes out to visit, I think you should take him to Muscle Beach down in Venice, because he likes to lift weights.
I can call Arnold, and Arnold will, you know.
Yes.
He will show it out. Yeah.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, I'm Anjali Vaidya. I'm a freelance writer. This is addressed to Jim. You'd use the phrase free market environmentalism. I'm a bit curious about that because, especially in the case of climate change, environmental and social justice are very closely intertwined. So I'm wondering how a free market approach would get to all the aspects of that crisis.
Yeah, so I'll give you just two examples that will go right to back to where we started with this panel. When I left my job in 2008, the federal government folks from EIA came over and said, you know how we've been telling you for 8 years how it's impossible to directionally drill for gas? Well, we were wrong. And they said, as it turns out, these guys have figured out how to do it. And the potential is massive. And they show me the maps. Federal government people show me the maps. I looked at the maps. I said, this is incredible. And do you mean to tell me that 4/5 of the available resource is on state and private land, not on federal land? And they were very chagrined, and they said, yeah, not very much on federal land. And I said, that's so great. It means it might actually get developed. Okay? Now, by free market, what I mean is the private landowners, and as it turns out, the states, including the state of California, said, let's develop this. Okay? Prices collapse. The market force displaces coal. Fracking has done more to displace coal than government policy. Okay? And it's resulted in the biggest chunk of greenhouse gas abatement. So any time we can get, and then it was the states figuring out how to enable that, but also control it, because it's very important to regulate the effects of that, that created this boom, okay, that is again, delivered $1 trillion of value to the economy, expanded something like 500,000 jobs, and given us this great resource. So free market, it's a great thing. Now I've got to do my own pitch. So my business, you all have cell phones, you all use data. Well, data centers are energy hogs and water hogs. They're not sustainable over the long term with their current practice. I'm working with a guy who has figured out, how to take a data center and improve its energy consumption by a third, right? 30% more energy efficient, zero water consumption, no water treatment chemicals, no greenhouse gas refrigerants. Okay? So that's a massive sustainability step forward at a significant savings, which means it might actually have a prospect of becoming ubiquitous as a replacement for what we've got. So anytime we can find the environmental improvement that comes at a net savings, we should be enabling that as much as possible. That is not to say, I want to agree with Mary, there are places where regulations are required and compliance must come at a cost. And there's a benefit-cost analysis to that. But given the choice between the two, I'd prefer compliance to come at a profit than compliance to come at a cost. And we should keep orienting our policy efforts toward that outcome.
Let's go to our final question.
Hi, Judy Fays from KUER in Salt Lake City. And I wanted to ask, I think particularly Jim and Kevin, Utah provided coal-fired power to California for many, many decades. And recently, the state and local governments have made decisions that would preclude Utah from getting its coal out of Oakland and shipping it overseas. Could you talk about how you see that issue playing out, the social justice and the climate issues and also California's reputation? What are you guys going to do about that?
Utah's a great state, and I've been there on a few occasions. We last year moved a bill that would divest our pension holdings for the teachers as well as public state workers from coal holdings. We did that for a whole variety of reasons. I know that the state of Utah and the coal companies arranged a deal with developers in the port of Oakland to move their product to the Pacific Rim, to other developing nations. We just came back from France. As mentioned earlier, climate change is not a California issue. It's not a regional issue, national issue, hemispheric issue. It is a global issue. So it's highly contradictory on our part to actually allow statutorily to move coal since the domestic markets are diminishing, incredibly so, for they can find other markets, particularly in non-grid developed developing nations, and move it elsewhere. So for us to participate in that would be highly contradictory. We're respectful of Utah. We buy the coal, and the biggest culprit for us is LADWP in Los Angeles, who will be diminishing their coal portfolio. But coal, as we know, is among the dirtiest pollutants in existence. As we talk about the issue of regionalization of the grid for the Western United States, that is a big issue that's on the table of exporting, dirty coal into California and undermining California's climate leadership, because we want to export our leadership. And let me just say one last thing, too, because Republican or Democrat, and irrespective of the variance of where you are in the spectrum, the political spectrum, you know, in a sort of non-ideological way, I think we've been not perfect, you know, and we always have to self-correct all the time. That's the whole process of self-correction, modifying, editing, is that non-ideologically, we've actually have become less carbon intensive, in parts of the state less polluted, and we have actually grown the economy and put people to work in jobs that are real and tangible that you can quantify and verify. And our economy is twice as large as the state of Texas. So the empirical data is there that's not up for different interpretations and political applications to drive an ideology, you know, or to protect legacy industries. We're actually trying to recalibrate a new economy of tomorrow to make sure that this planet is still available for the next generation and many generations to come, whether you're Republican or Democrat or agnostic. It doesn't make a difference, you know, so I just want to throw my two cents.
So we're running out of time, so quick comment from you, and then we'll go to Mary Nichols.
So two aspects. One, water sustains life. Energy enhances and prolongs life. Data enriches life, right? Education and communication enriches life. So I start anything, which is access to energy, especially for the poor, gets them out of being sustained into enriched and enhanced. And so, so first and foremost, more energy, including coal, being used around the world is poverty eradication. Okay. Now, coal is about, can you mine it in an appropriately regulated way, and can you consume it in a way that meets our emission objectives? Okay. And so it's very appropriate to then set limits related to that. We succeeded in making coal clean by being able to scrub it to 90% plus air pollution emission reductions, but now it's got a carbon problem. Okay, so and divestment. I'm all about consumer choice. If you don't want to invest in coal companies, don't. So that's fine. I'm all about consumer choice. However, it's largely symbolic when it comes to tackling climate change, because climate change is about America, California, America, the developed countries, and then ultimately, let's really say it's China, India, Brazil, South Africa, deciding on a certain trajectory on emissions. And let's call the number 80%, which is the number in Paris. That still leaves, at least for the near future, 20% in the mix for coal with uncontrolled carbon. And so we shouldn't be constraining the flow of coal to poor people who might take advantage of it while we're meeting our 80% numbers, bearing the burden as big, rich, developed countries to accomplish that. And so I think there's, again, I want to get performance-based technology neutral. And who knows, if coal is a viable industry over the next 30 years in a little bit, maybe someone will invest in the way to capture the carbon from that coal and why we would deny ourselves that energy resource.
So we're running over time. I just want to, this will have to be 30 seconds from each of you, and then we wrap it up. Mary Nichols.
Well, mine was a comment for the people of Utah, the reporter from Utah. I live in Los Angeles. I'm not only a customer of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which was getting 40% of its electricity from coal from out of state. I also served on that on the board of that utility, and I'm very well aware of the fact that the largest CO2 emitters in California are our Southern California municipal utilities, because we did not say we were only going to deal with the emissions inside our boundaries. We took responsibility for the CO2 emissions from the power that we import into the state as well. LADWP operated, in effect, as a benevolent but nevertheless a real colonial power in Utah for many years. We were the biggest taxpayer in the part of the state that we were in. I visited and I saw, we were underwriting this high school band. This is good, you know. But nevertheless, it's not sustainable. And the paradigm that we're working towards right now is one where we and Utah and other states in the West that are part of one large grid will be selling each other wind and electricity and geothermal and other kinds of clean power when they're available at different times of day, and we will all be better off.
Secretary Laird, final brief.
Yes, because this running over bumped the question you were going to ask, the closing question, which is what is the one to you unreported story in California, and I held up talking about it because that question.
Thank you
was
for backing me up on this.
Yeah, and I just wanted to answer that we have the largest network of marine protected areas off of any of the 48 states. It's been going for 8 or 10 years. It's based on science. The first blush of the science is that it's working. We negotiated with tribes to bring them in. And that is just a major unreported story that really could be a bellwether to the other 47 states.
Well, we could obviously continue on for another hour and a half, but we can't. And please give our panel a round of applause.